Fifth-year radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
Good afternoon. We are at the house of Uli Rushbier Schmidt, who is a literary agent and a person intimately linked to the figure of Arturo Barea, whose 60th anniversary of his death was commemorated last year and has been rediscovered here in the English-speaking world, particularly with the publication by Pushkin Press of The Forge of a Rebel. Uli, to start with, tell us about your origins, where you born and how you came to England, and how you get to know Arturo and Ilsa.
I grew up in Vienna. Both my parents died during the war, and I was brought up by my grandmother.
In Vienna?
In Vienna. She was a widow and then lost both her children in the Second War and looked after me and my cousin. And she was very close to Ilse, because Ilse's mother was her oldest sister. So my grandmother's parents died when she was a teenager. So she came to live with Ilse's mother, siblings, her sister Alice, mm-hmm. and her husband Valentin Pollock. So they were very, very close. And throughout the year, they kept writing letters to each other.
And so they stayed in contact. Jewish family, the whole family from Jewish extraction.
Half Jewish. Yeah, Ilse's mother was my part of the family. Ilse came back to Vienna, and I met her when I was 14. And she had not been back to Vienna before. She came to visit some relations and see what Austria was like. And I met her, and I went to some college I didn't like. And she said, I have had some of Arturo's nieces have come to Middle Lodge, mm-hmm. to help in the household and just...
So she was living in England at the time.
At the time,
and she went to
with Arturo.
Oh, with Arturo. So this is in the afterwar, isn't it? This is in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
40s, 50s, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we met, and I finished my college, and then she came to pick me up from Vienna in August 1956, when I was 17. And she took me to England, and we went to Middle Lodge, where they lived. And I came to learn English and to learn about typing, just help in the household. And because I didn't have any parents, yeah. Ilse was like a mother and Arturo was like a father. And they have had three nieces before who've all gone. Most have gone back. Anyway, I stayed there. And they took me, Arturo took me shopping to Farringdon, which he enjoyed doing. To Farringdon.
Okay.
And he took me with him on the bus, which went twice a day. And he cooked, he bought, went to the fishmonger, went to the butcher. I did a bit more. He went to the public house, to the pub, the volunteer, where he always stood by the bar and was talking to all the farm workers. Because in England, especially in those days, you had the public bar and the private bar.
I see. There was a division, class division within the pub.
Yeah, absolutely.
Three pubs?
Yeah. No, three bars.
Three bars.
Okay. Saloon bar, the private bar, and the public bar.
And yeah. The public
saloon
bar
was for Vilas or for...
No, the saloon was for elderly women.
People who sat.
Oh, I see.
Didn't stand,
okay.
You sat down.
You didn't mix, did you? Okay. What was the farmer's bar? Which one was the farmer's bar?
The public bar.
The public bar.
Where
okay.
The workers went.
And they were all standing, always standing.
And Arturo, so Arturo and Ilsa share more or less the same political views. They were very similar in political terms. Now, when you came to England and you came to live with them, I presume they have a very well-established routine. He was working for the BBC. Yeah. Ilsa was writing and translating. Ilsa was a biographer. I presume she was busy all the time.
Yeah.
Were you ever asked to help with any literary things, correcting documents? Were you asked to do that kind of stuff?
I did quite a lot, and I was asked to go through the daily newspapers and to have a look to see what could be of interest, and they looked at them, and I used to cut them out and stick them into big books, which are now sitting in the Bodleian.
Okay.
I did
the famous Oxford
that.
Institution.
And they had this big bag desk, no electricity. It was an old cottage which belonged to Lord Farrington's estate. A lodge, there are a number of lodges in these estates, and they had paraffin lamps. They called them tilly lamps, and you had to pump them up every day, you had to fill them, you had to light them.
Incredible.
We had radio with a battery, we had cooking with gas in gas cylinders, and we had one stove in the kitchen.
And you have to change the cylinders now and then.
And we had a stove in the kitchen, which was very difficult, and Arturo was the only one who knew how to make it burn, and that made the whole house warm.
Did they keep any animals?
Two dogs.
Two dogs, that's
one
domestic.
One boxer called Chico, and one...
But Arturo wasn't from the countryside, he was a very urban man.
He wasn't born in Madrid, he was in Badajoz, but he was a madrileño by life. He was a man from the city. Uli, did he ever mention to you why he decided to live in the English countryside, rather than to be in London, for example, since he was doing the broadcasting for the BBC?
I think he suffered, when he came out of Spain, he suffered from shock. And I think a city would have been too difficult for him.
He didn't mind visiting London.
He did that every week.
He had to come to London every week because his podcast was every week.
Every week.
Okay. He says in his CV that you gave me to look at that he preferred to live in the countryside because he liked the ambiance, he liked the country people. He fell in love with the English countryside.
That has a story. It's up there on the wall.
But it's quite interesting, Uli, isn't it, that he never had a lot of money. He also had a very frugal existence, so to speak.
Very much so.
In Spain and here, in the UK too.
Yeah.
So that didn't
in
change.
In Spain, he was very successful some period of time.
Yes,
he was a salesman.
Patent's office.
For this Hispano...
But he worked for the Republic, didn't he? He was for the Central... He was for the Republic. He was in charge of... He was in the Ministry of Communication, the equivalent to the Ministry of Communication.
He ran the Telefonica in the end.
Did he talk a lot about the Spanish Civil War? Because obviously he wrote this... He wrote it, and we are going to talk about the history of the book. I want your opinion about it, the fate of the book, because it's a curious one. But did he ever talk about it, or did he just wrote about it?
Told me this one story about coming out of the building and the bomb went off, and he looked around.
Well, there was a bomb in Madrid?
Yeah, and he looked around, and there was something stuck on the wall, and it was moving. It was a bit of somebody's brain, and that haunted him for the rest of his life. I think he was at that stage really suffering from depression, got worse and worse.
Yes.
And they managed to get to Paris and then came to England at the beginning of 39. But what...
His experiences in the Moroccan Rif War was also...
Well, that war was particularly bloody. It was very, very cruel. And the Spaniards have a lot of casualties in that war because of the inefficiency of the generals.
And the corruption.
And the corruption of the army. You know, Primo Rivera was part of that, and Franco was part of that war too. It's interesting. But how was his routine, for example, writing his broadcast for the BBC? Did he prepare them a lot?
His broadcasts were... He had various. He wrote about books, about Spanish writers, did critiques. He talked about political things in England, was happening in school, what was happening in the National Health Service, all these various things. And his broadcasts from the BBC, and I went with him sometimes. He took a taxi to the railway station, came to Paddington, and then to Bush House.
The Bush House, because the BBC was serving, was at the Bush House
in the Strand.
Near the Strand, yeah.
And he sat in a cubicle with a glass window, and he was talking.
And he was directed to the Latin American public.
Yeah, and he got lots of letters back from South America, which are also in the boxes, had an incredible admiration. The BBC sent him to a tour of South America, meeting three or four countries, of meeting the various people.
I think he went to Mexico, that's for sure.
Yeah.
He went to Mexico and Argentina.
Argentina and Chile, I think Paraguay.
Did he ever speak of his impressions of Latin America?
Oh, he liked it very much.
Like magic, yeah.
And he made great friends with the people in Argentina, very much in contact.
And I just wonder if he became aware that there's a huge legion of exiles, intellectual Spanish, who went to Latin America because of the Spanish Civil War. Many went to Mexico, Argentina, Colombia, Chile. Not many of those broadcasts survived, do they? I mean, there are quite a few, but I was looking for them on the internet, and I couldn't find any.
He did over 800, and I had... BBC sent it to me, over 500.
You go over 500?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're at the Bodleian now. And Eva did lots of scans of lots of them, and I've tried so hard to get the British publisher to show what a Spaniard during the war's experiences were in the British countryside or in England. And you're constantly reading things about the war still. Nobody, I have not yet found a publisher. And I had about 12 of them translated into English, but the rest is only exists in Spanish.
Had they been published in the Spanish language?
A number of them, and Nigel Townsend and Eva Nieto are in contact with a Spanish publisher. Who's going to publish everything with her too.
The book itself, The Forge of a Rebel, until then, when the book was published, I don't think many English people knew much about Spain.
No.
Spain remained a very isolated, savage, a strange country that it was not quite European.
No.
I presume Arturo's book was the first recount of what the Spanish life was like.
Yeah.
Just before the war and during the war.
And the different backgrounds.
And different backgrounds, yes.
And with his mother on one side, his uncle on the other side.
Yeah.
So he saw all different
The different sides, how the families became divided by, by the legions to Franco, to the Republic.
To one thing, after I got all these books, Ilse's sister was also a writer. She went to Denmark. And she, after she died, I got some of her papers. And Ilse's father, he was called Valentin Pollack. He was a very famous educationalist in Vienna. And he escaped with Ilse's sister first to Denmark and then came to live with Ilse and Arturo. They came just before the war in 1939. And they lived with them at various places, including Middle Lodge, where both of them died in the autumn of 1948.
in England?
In England, living with Ilse and Arthur. Arthur loved Ilse's mother, but they only spoke French because she didn't speak Spanish.
And did Arthur speak French?
Yes, so he spoke French with his mother-in-law, and they both lived until they died. And Arturo was terribly, so it was like a family.
Did Arturo integrate fully with English life, do you think?
Absolutely.
So he was very happy in England.
He really loved England.
When you read some of his short stories, you can tell he was an Anglophile. He knew all about the local policeman, where he lived. He knew about the man who used to turn up to sharpen people's knives. He knew about the man who used to turn up just for some hot water, who used to travel, a tramp, what they call a tramp in English. Yeah. And he noticed all these things that were features of English country life.
Yes. Reading the Forge of a Rebel, it's almost like an anthropological essay. He also describes every single character and individual in a town, in a village. He just sort of kind of unpacks the daily mundane life of a village. Yeah, I can imagine he will do that with the stories. Now, with the book itself, correct me if I'm wrong, Uli, he writes the books in Spanish.
Yeah.
But then Ilse translated into English.
Yeah.
And then something happens. It gets lost, the Spanish version, or it just he takes the English version and expanded.
I think what was meant to be is that when Arthur wrote the first book, it was partly framed in a way to be understood by everybody, in a way more simplistic, trying to explain what Spain was like. And when he moved to the next, and it was...
But he wrote it in Spanish. And
he was doing it in... And the first translation was very bad.
It wasn't done by Ilse?
No, it was done by Sefton. I can't remember.
Somebody else did it.
And so the first volume was published, was translated by somebody else. And Ilse then retranslated it, which was a very good translation. But I think the first manuscript disappeared somewhere, got lost. It's possible that Arthur got very frustrated with it.
And threw it away or something.
But I have not been there. There's quite a lot of correspondence about it, but I haven't found out.
Because that would be fascinating to have at this stage, isn't it? To see that first manuscript. Because sometimes people don't realize this. Translations can improve an original. And we got the impression that Ilse translations improve Arturo's first book, and then gave him the resources for changing the style for books 2 and 3.
I agree.
I'm afraid I can't really
comment on that.
His English was excellent.
So he was able to read
Ilse did not spend too much time talking. Ilse always said Arthur was the creative one, and Ilse was the intellectual one.
I see.
Very much so. And she admired Arthur's way of writing enormously. So she will have helped him in ways when he had difficulty expressing himself. But I never got the feeling, listening to them when they talked, that she would tell him what to say. That's not how it worked.
That's an interesting combination, that he was the artist, the creative, and the other one was intellectual. But nevertheless, Arturo, if his English was very good, he was able to read Ilse's translations very critically, looking at the quality of Ilse's work.
Yeah.
Ilse was a polyglot. She could speak 6 or 7...
I presume German, French, Spanish, English?
Hungarian.
Hungarian. Wow, that's Middle Europa, isn't it? That sort of kind of...
She was a classic Middle Europa person.
Indeed. She spent 9 months in prison in Hungary.
How? Why?
She was a communist.
Initially.
Even a socialist, a communist. Mm. Okay.
Yeah, and got totally disillusioned with communism. So she left to become a socialist on her last journey of the East, she got caught, and she spent 9 months in a prison in Hungary, sharing a cell with an Austrian woman who had killed her lover, cut him into bits, and threw him down the Danube.
Crime of passion, the Austrian way.
That woman told her how to embroider.
After the end of the Second World War, or before?
Oh, before.
Before?
In the 20s.
In the 20s. How did she meet Arturo? She met Arturo in Spain, didn't
yeah.
she?
Yeah. But before that, she was married.
So Arturo was her second marriage?
Yeah. Okay. She married a Czech called Poldi, and she was called Kucha, and they lived in Czechoslovakia for a while, came to Vienna, went back to Czechoslovakia when things got more difficult in Austria. They didn't, towards the end, didn't get on very well. He went to Spain and was active there, and Ilse also went to Spain, but separately, and went as a journalist for Austrian newspaper. She worked for the Arbeiterzeitung and did reports from there, and met Arturo at the Telefonica after she had...
At that time, it was possible to publish any progressive newspaper in Austria?
There was also some socialist paper she was involved in, but I can't remember what it's called.
She was very active across Europe, in many countries, because she went to Spain, during the Civil War.
Then she found herself in the censorship, Arturo, and Arturo didn't like her to begin with.
Really? Why?
Because she was obviously...
very talented and vocal.
Knowledgeable with languages. Can you imagine the power?
And an intelligent woman who speaks several languages and had been across Europe already, so she has a lot of experience.
And Arturo had to work with her because she knew what these journalists were speaking. And they were trying to sneak past him as a censor and get their interpretation, which was usually right-wing, of the Spanish Civil War, back to their newspapers, wherever they were, in America or in England. Yes. And she and Arturo, I think, got together on the basis of that
working together.
And probably also having the same ideas about the political situation. So there were some political sympathies to start with.
Yeah, very much so.
They were both married, unhappy.
Both of them, because Arturo was married before that, didn't it? What happened to that marriage?
He was married and had 4 children, and he did not get up. She sounded really awful, his wife. But he also had a mistress in the Telefonica, and Ilse told me, after she got there, after a while, after she'd fallen in love with Arturo, his wife and his mistress came to see Ilse. The mistress was working in a Telefonica and said, look, it's okay in Spain, it's okay to be married.
And to have a mistress.
But you're not allowed to fall in love with somebody.
What an incredible thing to say.
Yeah.
So you can have a mistress, you can have children, out of the wedlock, but you cannot fall in love with people.
This all comes out in The Clash, in the final novel. He talks about how he couldn't get on with his mistress.
Yes.
He used to go out on Sundays to somewhere just outside of Madrid, and it didn't work.
He
couldn't get on with his wife, had his wife in a little village just outside of Madrid with the children. And that didn't work.
Did his children ever visit him in England? No. Did he? No? No. So it was very...
However, they went to Argentina, and there is quite a lot of correspondence from them to Arturo.
From his children in Argentina, writing to Arturo? Okay.
Yeah, and they are in the boxes.
Well, probably they were listening to his father's broadcast.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, please.
Most likely, yes. And did they settle in Argentina?
Yeah.
And then, the escape from Spain, how does it happen? When did they get out? They get out in 1939? No.
38. Yeah. They managed to get to...
France?
To France, isn't
to
it?
To France.
They crossed to France.
Escaped to France. Paul D, her ex-husband, he'd helped them. And Ilse got divorced. Ilse got married in Spain. He got divorced. They both got... And Ilse's husband died very soon afterwards. He had cancer and he died very late. They escaped to France, where they had absolutely no money and were starving. Ilse was writing stories and Arthur was writing articles which Ilse translated in order to try and find people to publish it.
So while they were, it was a hand-to-mouth existence in Paris.
In Paris.
To get to here.
And they managed to get to England because Arthur did the lottery. And he got and some money.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, he told me about that.
So he won a lottery in France.
Paris.
That allows them to travel to England.
Yeah.
And this is 1939?
In 1939. But Ilse had friends in England. And they came to England. They went to live with somebody called Margaret Weedon, whom I also met still. She was a great, great friend. And by then, they lived with her. And Ilse's parents, when they came, also lived with her. And she worked at the BBC monitoring service at Evesham during the war. And she got a job to Ilse to go and work there. Yes. So Ilse spent the war years doing translating. And she told me she had to listen to all the foreign broadcasts and to decide what was real or what was fake news and which to pass on to the war.
Oh, so there was
two German stuff. From the
interesting what you said about what was real, what was fake news, you know, the fake news.
You didn't call it that.
It was called propaganda at the time.
The propaganda, at the time. And they were working in London.
No, BBC were in the countryside, Evesham.
In Evesham, okay.
Out past Oxford. And they lived in a village. They always lived in villages. They moved about three or four times.
Speeches by Goebbels, important speeches, people who spoke for the party. And she would listen, along with three or four others. Very important speeches to decide what was... bullshit was real, and then they'd pass it on to...
And the whole group who worked together, George Weidenfeld, a huge group of Europeans who came to England, escaped for political reason or because they were Jewish, and they all worked together. Ernest Gombrich was one of them, the art historian, a whole group. So Ilse lived with Margaret Weedon and they moved to various places. And then they met Lord Farrington, who was a socialist and went to Spain during the Spanish Civil War to drive...
A Lord Socialist, but that's fine, with sympathy for the socialists.
But he drove an ambulance during the war. And when... they came and met in England. He lived in Basket House, and Middle Lodge was one of the lodges. Yeah. And he rented the house to Ilse and Arturo for what they call a peppercorn rent. Cheap rent for life, which is...
just to keep the place going, basically. Yeah.
Excellent. You can stay there as long as you like. And I heard about it when the Hungarians separated. Arthur in 1956. Lord Farrington sent his car, his Rolls Royce, to Hungary to bring people from there to Vienna to help them escape.
Yeah. So that's the basis for the film Rolls Royce. Remember that film?
Yellow Rolls Royce.
But he had always been of course, not yes. very popular locally. He didn't yes. like hunting. He was not like any of the English yeah. lords.
He was homosexual as well. So.
Yeah.
At that time, you had to keep it, yeah. keep it very quiet. Much. Yeah, very
but
much
they
so.
Were very close, and he wrote quite a lot of letters. And they used to go there for dinner, and I was also invited with them yeah. to go to this very beautiful.
Has anybody written any biography about Arturo? My. Going around Europe at the time.
Yeah. Is there a biography of Arturo in the Spanish-speaking world?
Yeah.
Apart from Eva's PhD.
Michael Hewd.
Well, what?
He's written his biography.
Mm. Yeah. A biography on Arturo. On yeah. Arturo Varela. And he said, didn't have children with Arturo. Was a decision that they didn't want to have children? Was that an agreement between the two? Or?
And I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't know.
But neither of Ilse's siblings had children.
Probably she decided, well, it's too difficult. Who knows?
Yeah. It was just such turbulent times.
Yes. Ilse's work in Austria, how is it perceived? How is it read?
Do you mean after she went back
well,
again?
No, not that she went back. Even now, I mean, when you go to Austria, if you mention her name, is she known as Ilse Barrea or is she known as Ilse with her maiden name?
No, Ilse Barrea. When she went back to Austria, she was there for about 8 years before she died. She spent most of her time teaching women, trade union women, about history. And I have lots of lists of the subjects she was talking about. But that looking after people from working class background was part of her life. And what I discovered, her father and her mother, he was a big Viennese headmaster. Every summer they rented a school and took poor children from Vienna to the countryside and gave them a chance to have a holiday. Right. I discovered this because Valentin's autobiography yes. was in the box I got from Ilse's sister.
Into England, he was an educational.
Did it ever publish?
No. No.
But he also worked in a school in Vienna called the Schwarzwaldschule, where various Kokoschka taught art, Schönberg taught music. Who was the other one? Mm-hmm. A couple of other people.
The
socialist crowd of Vienna.
Ilse worked with the International Trade Unions Congress. She did work with the United Nations. She translated for them.
And she travelled to
Auschwitz, where she obviously went in the 50s and 60s
yeah,
to
big
talk
pictures.
At these trade unions.
The period yeah. of
yeah. As an interpreter.
An organ called, a newspaper called the Eisenbahner, which is all about railway work. So, and she wrote for Workers' News.
Yeah.
In certain ways, you got the impression that she could have been an intellectual writing novels and plays and who knows, or even script for films, but she decided to work with trade unions yeah. and working yeah. class people.
Yeah.
If very you read her book, and I read it in the summer in Spain, called Vienna.
Vienna.
Which took
her book.
Her Vienna. Book.
Her okay. book. It she wrote her history of Vienna.
13-14 years to write it, and you can tell.
Is it in Spanish or English?
In English.
It's in English.
It was published in Spanish. They've discovered the Spanish.
But it's published also in the UK. As Ilse Barrea, Vienna.
Yes. Published by Faber and Faber. Wow. Book on demand, which means you need to...
You need to pay for the book
for
before...
it and they'll print it for you.
You pay yeah. for it, we print it for you.
Okay. I found it a real struggle. There's the book there.
And where did you find the struggle?
Because she's writing... You can tell she put the book down after 2 years, then she picks it up
yeah.
3 years
did
later.
Did a huge amount of
I could cost many people making comments on that.
And she talks about Viennese culture yes. and the theatre and music.
And painters.
I found it really difficult to relate the Ilse in this book to the Ilse Telefonica, translating Durer's work, The Forge, The Track and The Clash, the work inside Europe at that time.
It could be that she saw the contrast. I mean, the Vienna, which is aristocratic, imperial, and the other Vienna.
She talks about her childhood. She talks about going out into the countryside outside of Vienna. She talks about her mother describing the flowers and the plants. And you can understand her love of art
country.
And music.
But remember also Vienna at the turn of the century was a center of culture. Everybody was there. Wittgenstein, Hitler was there for a while, for better or for worse, he was there. Kafka passed through Vienna.
Yeah. This right town, Comitriza in Brazil.
Zweig was there. I mean, Art Nouveau was there. Klimt, yes, exactly. Vienna was a very the center of what was happening at the time in Europe in the 1920s. Yeah. So Ilsa in the 20s was what? She was a teenager.
She was a young socialist.
She was a young socialist. Yeah, receiving all these things going on in Vienna at the time.
She became so politically involved. She became an embarrassment to the family.
Really?
Oh yes.
Her uncle was.
Her uncle was Vice Chancellor of Austria.
Really?
There was a big headline
so she
in
had
the newspaper.
A socialist niece.
Yeah, she was in prison.
In Hungary.
That was in the paper. He was chief of police and he then became Vice Chancellor of Austria. And I've got pictures of him. And he was my granny's brother-in-law.
And when she went back to Vienna.
Yeah.
What did she make out of the post-war Vienna?
It would be very interesting to know.
Did she ever write about it?
I can tell you one thing. Interestingly enough, she and that woman, Margaret Whedon, with whom she worked at the BBC, she got married and went to live in Australia for a number of years. And I got an email from somebody to say that she would like to meet because she has found some, she knows about me and she writes personal things about me. Yeah. So I met her in London. It was an Australian woman whose friend found a box of letters in Sydney in a rubbish dump. And there were letters from Ilsa to Margaret Whedon. And they were the closest of friends. And she gave me copies of the letters.
And Ilsa is writing from Vienna to Australia?
No, that
she was in England.
As well as Australia. Okay. And there was all that correspondence. I have lots of correspondence to her brother who went to Australia. Constant letters.
Yeah.
To her sister, who was a writer.
So she was a letter writer, Ilsa.
They all were.
But it was the way people communicated at that time. In those days?
Yeah.
Before email, you just wrote a letter. You penned the letter.
And her sister married a diplomat, so she was stayed in New Zealand and in Prague, and he became Danish ambassador to the United Nations in America. So all that correspondence of the family is like that. And not just the boxes of the family. Letters from people from all over. I'm Russian. Can you help me find my brother, my sister? Have you been there? Have you heard that? Lots of correspondence of people in England. My neighbour has lent me some money. I'm helping somebody else. Somebody has given me a bed. And all that basic correspondence of everyday life. And the English people were just fantastic.
Uli, just talking to me, it just occurred something I never thought before. And perhaps it's a little biased, and perhaps partial knowledge. Austrian culture and Viennese culture somehow has quite a few families doing things. The Wittgensteins were a family, the Strauss were a family. Ilse, so all these kind of families working in certain sectors. Very rich aristocratic, cosmopolitan, very cosmopolitan, very well educated, very well educated families of intellectuals, but families, entire generation of families of intellectuals. And Ilse's family seems to be like that too.
Yeah, her sister was an incredible
That's
woman.
Ilse's grandfather.
And who is this?
He was 18 in the army.
And who is he?
What's Ilse's grandfather. Was the father of my grandmother and Alice.
Did he find Napoleon by any chance? Probably he did, really. I don't know. Who ever knew that?
Emperor Joseph
was the emperor. In the Habsburg Empire, I have letters from him.
Bismarck. Probably these people were, during Bismarck, trying to unify all the Germanic people. The Austrians got big problem with the Russians.
Yeah. Well, the Habsburg Empire went all the way till Russia, borders of Russia, And I have letters from him to his mother in the army in Italy, talking about various other people he's in the army. So that was part, and Ilse does talk about him and that family.
This book is a difficult read, because it only goes up to 1840.
No, beginning of the First World War.
One question only, going back to Arturo, when you read all this new evidence and new books of the Spanish Civil War, English historians talking about the Spanish Civil War through documentation, whereas Arturo is talking about the Spanish Civil War through his own experience, to what he actually lived.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you feel about it?
I write how history is made from inside, not from outside.
Yes, is that the thing, isn't it? Because he is a historian writing from within. I mean, he lived that life. He didn't have to consult documents or archives. Or, no, he lived it.
No, he did live it.
He
wasn't an academic.
Yeah, he wasn't an academic. That's the anthropological part of it. The priest that he has conversations with about God and stuff like that. I said, look, doesn't matter. And he also wrote about philosophers, Unamuno. He wrote about the particular generation of 1998. Lorca.
You read his book, Struggle for the Spanish Soul, which he wrote in 1939, I think. You can feel the influence of George Orwell.
Yeah.
When I read that book, I said, I can hear Orwell.
Well, yes.
I can hear the discussions that are taking place in England at that time, in 1939.
And do you think that Arturo wrote that book after reading Orwell, or not? Or he didn't know Orwell at that time?
Orwell was his editor.
Yes, you are.
So, did he work at Faber at Orwell?
No, Orwell was an editor of this.
So Orwell was Arturo's editor?
Yeah. But The Struggle for the Spanish Soul is a wonderful book.
I would like to read that one. That's brilliant.
If you read this after you've read the trilogy, The Forge, The Track and The Clash, it brings it all together. You understand trilogy.
What was Arturo's impression of intellectual life in England, and particularly in London? The intellectual life in Madrid, or Spanish intellectual life, he felt very distant from it. But how was the one here in England?
The Spanish posh people. He didn't like the Tertulias in Madrid.
In England, I think it was different. He loved being with people.
Yeah.
And
was he gregarious?
Very gregarious. And he talked to everybody, anytime, anywhere. And he had lovely sense of humour. He liked to pull people's legs.
Very good.
And
that's nice.
His Spanish, his English, sometimes he pronounced at the beginning, I found it a bit difficult. My English wasn't good, and the way he spoke English is the way he wrote it. So it was quite difficult. But he was able to come across as this sort of.
I have that on my desk.
Oh, nice.
It's absolutely perfect.
Perfect.
It's just how I remember.
Cigarette in hand, brown fingers.
Yes. Was he a heavy smoker?
Heavy.
He smoked 60 a day. Whoa. Ilse smoked 40 a day. Gosh. And the ceiling in was, the cockpit was brown.
Like the Routemaster bus.
Oh my gosh.
That's, and you can see, yes, he used to bleach them with bleach.
This radio podcast that he did. Is any plans of making it available to the public for people to have an ocean of his time?
Nigel Townsend has found a Spanish publisher. I can't remember the name, but I can tell you who it is. Signed the contract, and that publisher is a small publisher in Spain. But he wants to publish everything Arturo has ever written. So all the broadcasts are going to be available in Spanish.
But the voice, the interesting thing will be the voice and the delivery of the voice.
There is one broadcast.
Available?
Yes, I know Nigel William Chislett.
It would be interesting to hear his voice. I just wonder what his voice sound like. You know.
It's a nice voice.
No Spanish accent. I presume
it's
not very...
it's only a bit of it, I think, somebody has.
No, it's the...
have you heard his voice?
He's from the southwest part of Spain, and they got like a different accent compared to the... But he's neutral compared to Madrileño or to the one from his own region.
Does he sound like an Andalusian then?
No.
No, he wasn't that. No.
Exactly. And probably the exile also meant what Jorge says, that his language became much more neutral. That happens when you leave away for such a long time.
And I suppose you spent some time working in a bank, so of course he had to be also.
Let's be properly clear.
He worked for Credit Leone from when he was 12 to when he was 18.
No, he worked shop before. Yes, he did.
So he was a señorito, what you say in Spanish, a properly educated gentleman who had to present himself well-spoken.
When he went to these meetings in the early days of the coming civil war, because he was dressed like a...
Like a señorito? Like a señorito, like a banker, like TSL you used to dress.
I found his CV, which he wrote himself, and which also translated into
English.
No, I think somebody else translated it, which you might find interesting.
Biography, not 1940.
That was written 1940.
It's like a presentation letter.
Talks about being born in Badajoz and then leaving when he was
in Badajoz and brought out in Madrid from the age of 2 months. He was a Madrileño. When my father died, the outline of my early childhood had been given to the forge. No means whatsoever. In order to maintain herself and her 4 children, went to work as a washerwoman on the banks of the river Manzanares.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Her mother used to wash clothes on the river.
Did you not know that?
I didn't know that at all.
I knew.
If you think about, in this moment of crisis, you got this resurgence of culture and ideas. The world as they knew it was actually disappearing.
Yes.
So that's the reason why they came up with all these new ideas.
Yeah.
The old order disappearing, being diluted.
I think that's what Stefan Zweig said in Brazil. The old world collapsed.
Yes, he goes to Argentina, goes to Brazil and commits suicide in Brazil. Right. Look, Stefan Zweig, looking at Europe.
Looking at Hitler's...
Exactly. But imagine you being from Middle Europa, imagine being a Czechoslovakian and Austrian, or even a progressive German, and seeing what's going on in your country.
Left.
It has to be so dreadful.
And we threw them in prison.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Our enemies.
Ilse is imprisoned on the Isle of Man for a short time.
Why?
Interned.
Because he had an Austrian name. He had an Austrian passport.
Anything with an German ancestry or Austrian ancestry was an enemy.
But Europe at the time was like a crazy continent.
It was.
I mean, like that was experience.
And, Churchill said, lock them up. Everyone who had a German name or who was connected, they locked them up. And then gradually they came out, like Ilse's father.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful story where Arturo talks about... No, Ilse's father, Valentin, talks about coming back to a village in wherever it is, looking for Ilse, looking for
his wife,
and looking for Arturo. and they've moved. And poor Valentin didn't know what the hell he'd come
didn't
back.
Didn't know from where the they were.
He didn't. He had a suitcase, and he didn't know where they were.
Yeah.
And the local people brought him into their house, gave him some food, told him to calm down. We'll find Ilse for you. We know where she's gone. She moved to the next village or something like that. And eventually they were reunited. And I think that made a deep, deep impression, not just on Valentin, but on Arturo,
yeah.
of how okay. genuine the English
people were.
Yeah. And he did, he went radio talks to be done in English, and one of them also translated and was broadcast here, where he talks about when Alice died. Arturo talked about his mother-in-law in England, how the village loved her, yeah. how she was so nice, so friendly, and he describes in the most beautiful, really moving way, the way he adored her and the way all the people around her came to her and loved her, and she looked after everybody.
He really loved his mother. He write a lot about that.
Arturo's mother.
But also his mother-in-law.
That's Ilse's mother.
The Italians, the Spaniards are mother.
Yes.
But he was really special. The love he got
for
his mother was
exceptional. Yes, it comes through in his writing. It's very strange. Because like Uli, my parents were both dead by 1955. So I have no idea what... mothers and fathers.
One English biographer, I think he knows about Arturo, he said that he wanted to transform his mother from washerwoman into a señora.
A fair lady.
He was always
worried
about his mother and the amount of work that she did down at the river, you know, washing...
Manzanares, washing clothes.
For these...
rich people.
It's a dreadful stuff, isn't it?
The relationship between his rich uncle and the aunt who hated his mother, who was always... bed and all this kind of stuff. That's really
but you know in Arturo's book on the Forge of the Rebel, but that really comes across that people have no aware of that. Hunger of Spanish people in the countryside and the hunger of a large number of Spanish people basically surviving with very little food.
It was for Latin American writer who went to Spain, who was surprised.
Very surprised.
The hunger was going around during the 20s.
And 30s.
People were surprised.
Anthony Vivor, on the historian, he rewrote the Spanish Civil War book because he went to the archives in Moscow, so he got some information when the perestroika allowed them to consult some of the Moscow documents. But one of the things he says in the book is like,
Bakunin,
the anarchist, was huge in Spain. He was adored. He was a mythical figure in Spain. The hunger, I mean, the people really became anarchists. And part of this, the anarchist movement was one of the fragmented the left when they were fighting Franco. Yeah. The anarchists didn't want anything to do with anything.
No.
But these anarchists came from a sense of injustice.
The landowners but
exactly. Like, and the church, and the attitude of the church, being very centrist country with the Catholic Church. The other element of hunger, you have it in Quixote. Read the first pages of Quixote. The first two pages. It's about hunger. It is about hunger. I mean, people do not realize. People talk about the hunger in Ireland and probably what happened during the Nazi occupations. But in Spain, it lasted for a long, long, long time. Mm-hmm. We're talking about hundreds of years.
This is why you had anarchists.
Yeah, but that's why you had anarchists, yes. The hunger actually, I think, fed using that ironical thing.
They didn't know about anything.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's it. But Arturo talks about the hunger too in the book.
Yeah, he does.
And it's something like, you know, and it's something that they, and I was saying to Uli, I mean, if you read the book, probably this was the first book about Spain that actually came to the English speaking people. Because before that, Spain was not Europe. Spain in the 1930s and 40s was not Europe. And remember, Franco was the only. And Franco was the only dictator, the only fascist that survived, because he was isolated. Who sent the meat from Argentina? Juan Domingo Perón. He has an avenue in Madrid called Juan Domingo Perón because he was feeding some of the Spaniards, not everybody. Mm-hmm. It is interesting how Spain, the history of Spain, is part of the Spanish Civil War. And then you got this era, which is still kind of unknown to Europeans, which is the Franco dictatorship. Because Franco dies in 1975, mm-hmm. much, much later. So basically, when Arturo died, there's another what? Another 18 years of Franco. 18 more years of Franco. Imagine that.
I know.
Arturo died, Elsa dies, and Franco's still in power.
Yeah.
Franco's still alive.
Not only in power, consolidated.
Incredible.
Real power.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not something like this.
We're talking about a dictatorship that lasted what? From 1940 to 1975. That's 35, 36 years.
Well, it's still there.
Yeah. In La España Profunda.
Not only that, the division. The division
of
Great.
Still there.
Yeah.
That huge
you got the problem with
monument that they've now been arguing about for the last four or five years.
Yeah, and you could argue
the
that.
People were assassinated at war. Yes. Thousands of people were assassinated.
Yeah.
Not during the war, after the war.
Yeah.
Uli, did Ilsa feel very British? Did she feel an Anglophile like Arturo was?
She was very happy here. But after Arturo died, and I found various letters, part of her life died. We're so close that she never got over it.
Close and creative.
Yeah, it's a creative relationship too, yeah.
I think it was incredibly close.
Soulmates.
Uh-huh.
Really? Yeah.
What we would call soulmates.
Yeah.
Once in a lifetime.
Yes.
People who found each other.
Very special, yeah.
And the way Uli describes them, sitting at this big desk in Middle Lodge, firing ideas backwards and forwards, you know,
for hours.
Shouting,
hours.
Discussing.
They worked together. Each had a typewriter. Arturo made the desk, which you saw. She still had.
Arturo was a good carpenter then. Okay.
He was a good craftsman.
Yeah.
And he mended this clock. A spring had broken.
Yeah.
And through during the war, he found some woody.
A whalebone
from somebody's corset.
Really?
With which he mended the clock.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
It still works.
Excellent.
And it still works. Yeah.
Excellent.
But he was, engineer anyway. So he
That's
was
what he talks about his scientific sort of thing. His craftsmanship, isn't it?
He was famous in our circles in Madrid because he was really very. In Spanish, say manitas.
Mm.
It's good with his hands.
Yeah.
Good with his hands.
And he was very good mathematically. He was very good at physics. He understood all that. And when you read in The Forge about his relationship that he had with his teachers, they knew he was intellectually powered with mathematics and physics. And they brought him, they made him flower. And he passed all these exams, which is why the rest of the family, his family hated him.
Because he was a clever one.
Before the war, the intellectual activity was amazing. Something out of this world. Not even in Mexico, Argentina, we had something like that. In Spain, was amazing.
Mm.
But the creativity that was even going everywhere, in science, in arts, literature, kill off.
If you look at Spain is punctuated by two generations. The generation 98, Unamuno, but the generation of 1898 when Spain loses the last of his colonies, which is Cuba, to the Americans.
Puerto Rico
and Cuba. And then the generation 1927, which is the generation of Lorca, brilliant writers, Alberti, Machado, major writers, particularly poets, and brilliant poets in the Spanish-speaking world. And that generation was the one that collapsed because of Franco.
But what's science again? Science and technology was really going up. The first in Spain.
It was very backwards.
Yes.
Yeah,
it was very backwards.
But it was going up.
But Franco put them backwards again.
A genius for destruction.
Latin America benefited from that. If you
Mexico
look at
Mexico
and Argentina, many intellectuals.
Produced in the 20th century was translated by the Spaniards.
Yeah.
And was published in Mexico, Argentina. Mm-hmm. And for many Latin America, it was our university about the European thinking or culture.
There were certain publishing houses like Siglo XXI, Editores in Mexico, Sudamericana. There were certain places, but you would have the books that you needed to read, they published them.
They were there.
And they were the European books that you want to have.
The best.
So you will have people like Stefan Zweig, you will have people like Wittgenstein in Spanish, translated in Spanish.
In English.
Well, imagine Wittgenstein being translated in Spanish in the 1940s, 1950s.
Or Heidegger,
for that matter. What the heck? And all these great European philosophers.
It was done by Spaniards.
And there were Spanish who were very much involved with
that. Really the best thing, but most of them went to Mexico.
Mm. Put it this way, without Franco, Spain would have been, Spain now is a European modern country, with all the problems that Spain has. Spain is European and very modern. Spain is not what it was. But if you think about it, without Franco, Spain would have reached that point very, very long, in the 60s and 70s.
Franco wanted to make Spain apart from Europe. Yes. He thought Spain was so special that you don't need Europe, you need France, you don't need England.
He was an old imperialist.
I mean,
I couldn't believe how backward it was. I mean, it really was backward. There was one baker, and you had to get there at the right time to get some decent bread. And
Where is this?
There was one telephone in the village. Competer, it's just up the coast from Almeria.
Okay.
But now, Competer is full of estate agents driving around in 4x4. Yeah. Because when they lost the peseta and they brought the euro in, all this grey money came in from everywhere.
There is another side with the Franquismo, which is they are against capitalism. Do you understand?
Yeah.
It affects a lot of country.
Yeah.
You got a regime which is actually against capitalism and freedom. They go together.
Yeah.
I don't know somehow, but they go together. And if you don't apply that, your society became really backward.
Yeah.
Easily in years, and you can see that. I went to Spain the first time during the 80s. It was the opening of the country, and I went back 10 years later, and I saw the progress. Immediately in Madrid and all around Madrid, and you say, well, the Spaniards are all the people, they really change.
Are you a Spaniard?
No, I'm from Colombia.
Colombia.
During the Franco regime, even my father was very conservative. He hated him. My father said to me, how you got in Spain a military commanding a country like Spain? He said, you don't know what is a sergeant.
People tend to forget that the Iberian Peninsula was controlled by military men for quite a few years, during the 20th century.
Portugal, Spain, 40 years. And sometimes we are ashamed because we got military in Argentina and all kinds of war. In Spain and Spain, Italy, and Portugal, with these people, horrible people in control with the church and the army controlling the country, actually in education. In Colombia, it's horrible, but we never have an education that controlling primary education, secondary education, national education. We never have that control of the army or the church in our education. We never have that. We never had books that said, you cannot read these books, cannot watch these films. I remember when the Spaniards went to France to watch films where they were not allowed. You can't even imagine that.
Yeah.
The queuing. Queuing at the weekend, going to France.
Going to Paris.
And talking about censorship, because Arturo was involved with that, the censorship that happened during the Franco era was curious on many accounts. One of the curious accounts was this. All films were dubbed. So basically, if you have a relationship of a man and a woman who were not married, the dubbed version made them married. You know, there was no kind of, you know, that kind of stuff. Everything goes according to the orthodoxy of Franquism and Catholic Church.
We got subtitles, and somehow you became familiar with the English. You understand, the beginning is different, but then you became familiar with them. Even the American English is more difficult than the British one. Mm. But when you watch Spanish films, John Wayne speaking like Madrileño. Yeah, you understand, John Wayne speaking like so, or Frank Sinatra, like someone from Madrid. You say, wow, this is something. I mean, it's very artificial.
But Franco put that. I mean, the whole thing was
to protect.
To protect some values.
Yes,
the values. It's
going to what? The
moral
values.
The Virgin Mary.
Anyway, yeah. At the end, you got the Madrileña middle class, and they are bilinguals. Speak English and Spanish. In our conversation, what we have here is something I read about that during the war and before the war, the problems of people going around, progressive people. How was it for them to really to carry on without becoming crazy, really, or commit suicide? Mm. Which is
Soriano talked about that, you know, when he talked about the struggle for the Spanish soul and the broken root. And he met quite a few Spaniards who had left Spain after the Civil War.
Who were very unhappy.
Who were broken, who were destroyed, who felt completely disorientated.
Yeah.
Who didn't settle.
And they couldn't settle
here. They couldn't settle in Argentina.
Not even in Mexico. They were happy because, I mean, familiar.
They knew
given
what happened.
Accent,
they'd seen their country destroyed by Franco and fascism.
Yeah. Not only that, I think my idea is Spain was flourishing. Franco destroyed something which was anew in that country. Mm. Something really special. That's why it's so sad.
If you look at the Spanish history, just before Franco, you got a dictatorship, which was Primo Rivera, who actually kind of prepared Franco in many ways. So his dictatorship collapses, and then you got a progressive government, socialists, where people like Arturo comes from, they be part of the republic, intellectuals, people said, okay, this is our chance. We can really change this country. And then, bang, Franco. Yeah. So it's that lapse of kind of hope that lasted, what, 8 years, 10 years? Yeah. I need
to
look at the dates.
The problem, Franco, is not that he destroyed a democratic government. Is that he wanted to change the Spanish manner. He thought he knew how he was. I mean, to do that, he killed a lot of people.
Hmm?
You understand?
Yeah.
He wanted to eradicate liberal and progressive ideas. Hmm. Not communists. Liberal and progressive ideas. That was changing Spain. Not communists. Communists never strong in our countries.
But that
progressive, yes, and liberal ideas, which are the more, I mean, the ones who really change things fast in every sense, in every part of society. And he destroyed that.
Mm.
And as a result, that you go to Spain. And
he also put families against
each other.
I had that experience when I was a child in Austria. I was about 9 years old. My uncle, the one who died in the war, married a woman from northern Germany.
A Prussian.
The Austrian hate the Prussian, isn't it? Isn't
that
true?
Mm-hmm.
And she lived with me, my grandmother, and her own daughter in a village where we had a cottage. We left Vienna because we were frightened of the Russians. So we went from the flat in the middle of Vienna to the cottage.
So you left Vienna when the Russian army was advancing?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
Cottage, what happened is the flat in Vienna was in the American sector, and the cottage in the country was in the Russian sector.
That's a nightmare, isn't it?
And yeah. we had a Russian put into the cottage with his footman.
Yeah.
And one day, my aunt, the one from Prussia, was told to go to the town hall in the village. And she took me with her, because in those days, women were very frightened about the Russians. So if ever they'd have a little child, and that the Russians loved kids. So I was always taken.
They wouldn't already the woman with a child.
Anyway,
yes.
We went.
Enki and Uli went to see the.
Went to the town hall, and she was asked whether she came from Russia, and she said yes.
Russia.
Yeah.
And he said, and then she had two children, and I was separate. And he said, you are allowed to take one suitcase, one child, and we will pick you up tomorrow. So we went from the village up to the cottage, and my grandmother was very feisty. Yeah. She said, take Uli straight down to the railway station, straight to the flat in Vienna. So we ran down the hill, managed to get onto the train, which was full with people sitting on the top, and we escaped to Vienna. And the next day, when the Russians came to pick her up, my grandmother said, I've no idea, she's not, don't know where she is.
Yeah.
And she was lucky she could have been shot. But we discovered later that one woman in the village told the Russians about her being there. It was a neighbor. It was a neighbor, three houses away. And I tell you one thing. When we went there one summer, we met an American, and we talked to him. And he was older than me, and we talked about our summer here. We've been up the mountain going swimming. He was Jewish. And this woman was the housekeeper of his family. And they had to escape, and this woman took the house and sat in the house.
Oh, there you are. But that happens.
And
that happens.
She was the one.
That happens a lot during the war, isn't it?
Yes.
The opportunists.
Sure,
the opportunists. Yeah. The
absolutely everywhere.
It was a change of property.
Yes, I like your house because your house is bigger than my house, or prettier than my house. Bang. I will put you in, you know, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Expropriation.
But I had two children at school. Yes. My best friend, when I was seven, I heard her mother died. I heard later she was Jewish and she was shot in the village.
Oh.
The other friend I was good friends with didn't have any parents, but stayed with an uncle in a farm. I used to go there a lot. I found out much later that somebody in the village denounced her parents as being Nazis.
Mm.
And they were both shot.
Do you think,
the little village.
Do you think that the fact that after the war, France somehow and England produced a very brilliant intellectuals compared to Germany or Austria is due to the expulsion of the Jewish people? They were very powerful in the...
Possibly.
Well, if you think about the Jewish people, the Americans benefited by the Jewish exodus to America, and not only with the creation of the atomic bomb. If you go to the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, what you find is all donated by Jewish families to the American Museum of Science. Yeah.
Oppenheimer.
People like Freud came to live in London, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But if Valentin, Ilse's father wrote his autobiography, which I have, in English and in German.
Yeah.
And he describes growing up as a little Jewish boy in Austria, close to Vienna, and he describes the intermingling of the local population.
With the Jewish.
And even, yes, but he felt himself as a German speaking, he taught Latin and Greek specialist on the French
Revolution.
And for him,
yeah.
Goethe and all the various huge German thinkers was part of his life.
Nice.
And although we were totally anti-Nazi, all that was something he grew up, which must have been doubly difficult. If you consider yourself, and he loved the music and he loved the countryside, took all the kids up the mountains. A lot of his description of spending his life in Vienna and around there was this incredibly close involvement with Austria as a country and the people in it.
But it's the case, isn't it, only that you have this hugely uprooting of people across Europe, as happens during the Spanish Civil War. And if you think about Ilsa and Arturo, were product of that uprooting. It was both of them. But perhaps the congeniality that they have was that surviving uprooted and surviving in a different environment, having to live from your wits and ideas, but also appreciating what you have been given by the hosting nation, so to speak. The interesting thing what you were saying was about how people didn't feel at home anywhere else. And I just wonder if today that is the same. I think people tend to be much more international nowadays.
Yes, because you travel
much. Because you travel much and stuff like that. So this is sort of kind of...
It's a different world. It's a different interpretation.
It's a different interpretation of values and nationalism and identity and all that sort of stuff.
People don't read history anymore, I don't think.
People are selective about how they consume history.
Very selective.
And schools are particularly bad about, you know, but yeah. English schools are bad in the way they teach history.
Uli's Valentin taught at English grammar schools here. When he came back from incarceration on the Isle of Man, where the English had put him in prison, he came back and he was...
teaching history in English grammar schools.
He got a job as a teacher. He went to teach in English grammar schools.
Yeah.
And he was stunned by how ignorant the English education system was, because all we talked about was Plato and Aristotle and blah, 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 blah. And then it stopped.
And they knew nothing about
it. But it's still nowadays. If you look at the curriculum of a secondary school student,
yes.
In England.
Yeah.
What do you study? You don't study the Greeks. You bypass the Greeks. You study a little bit of the Egyptians.
Yeah. If you like.
And then what you do? The Romans. And then from the Romans, you jump.
Yeah. But
you talk about the Black Death.
Yeah.
And then you jump to the Tudors. Henry VIII. Victoria. Then First World War. Second World War. And then you stop there. And Hitler becomes an obsession. An obsession with the Second World War. An obsession because... in certain ways, they look at a European country like Germany, and after the war, Germany has recovered and become, again, the powerhouse of Europe. There's something that is perplexing for them. It's like, okay, but there's one fundamental reason. The Americans and the British decided to carry on with the building of weapons, and the Allied winners decided, okay, we can build the weapons and sell the weapons to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The other countries, like Japan and Germany, who were defeated, they have to produce goods.
Good
to the rest of the world.
Good
quality goods that people wanted to consume. The cars and the televisions and the computers. And that became, if you look at those countries, Japan is the third economy, Germany is the fourth economy in the world. The economy of Germany is twice the size of Great Britain. Twice.
Mm-hmm. Bombed it flat.
Exactly.
You dropped two atoms.
Yes, in Japan. Two atomic bombs in Japan.
You think it was because the Germans had to start from the scratch?
Well, they did start from scratch.
They
cancelled the debt in Woods. They cancelled the debt. Cancelled. And because the preponderance of the population that was educated joined the SS during the war, all the doctors, all the lawyers, all the accountants, all the policemen, they all were brought back in to denazify. Weird is that. When I was a teenager, my ambition was to go and work in Volkswagen, because I knew people who were going to Germany and they were coming back with all these fancy clothes and lots of money, because you could get a job in Germany during the 60s, make a lot of money.
Much better paid.
Yeah.
Well, but that was an American program. That was an American program. The same that they did the program with Japan. If you look at the program with Japan, was this, keep the emperor, but democratize the country.
Yeah.
Democracy was through bombs, martial law to all the military chiefs, but just keep Hirohito there. What happens with Hirohito? Go to Disneyland. to hunt butterflies. Fine. It's okay. The Americans said fine, because they wanted continuity. But the whole thing about the God Emperors goes. So you bring democracy to Japan. Yeah, it was an American program.
They were already militarized.
Oh, they were very militarized. Yeah, yeah. Oh, they were. Maybe they were millions.
So it's so easy to build factories and just march them in.
In certain ways, yeah, it is the same as in Germany. The same as in Germany.
Similar.
Yeah. Similar. There's nothing about that.
The other thing is the call to death.
Yes.
I mean the suicides in Germany before the war and in Japan during and after the war.
Yeah.
Amazing number of people committing suicide.
And now.
Yeah,
that's true. It's new. This modern affliction among young people in Japan.
Yeah.
Themselves away in rooms.
Yeah.
And then they communicate with each other on the internet.
Yeah.
Then they meet somewhere and they have group suicides.
Are you from Spain?
No, I'm South American too. We're both South American. But I live in Spain for about 2 years. And I've been to Spain so many times.
And we
work with an Argentinian and a Mexican, and we got this radio podcast.
Yeah.
You did an interview with Adam Freudenheim, the managing director.
Yeah, I listened to some of it.
Yeah. Did you listen to some of it? Okay, yes.
Not all of it yet.
But combination, yes, we were talking about it. Did you like it? Oh,
yes.
Good. Yeah,
I discovered one of the books he's published, Ilse translated, from German into English. He didn't know Adam Freudenheim. Yeah.
He's the managing director of Pushkin Press.
Yeah, we listened to him.
I was listening to your interview with Freudenheim.
Freudenheim, yeah.
While I was trying to work on the other side of the office. Now I recognize your voice.
It was a very sort of informal interview, which is fine, but I think they do a fantastic job. They do a brilliant job. But they are for this, what we call in Spanish, la gran minoría, the large minority.
Yeah.
This selected minority of people who will be reading people like Arturo, Stefan Zweig, yes. In fact, Pushkin Press was built on Stefan Zweig's translations. There you are.
Uli bought me his collected works several years ago.
Yeah.
Published by Pushkin.
Pushkin, yes.
If this guy was the publisher then.
Yeah, managing director, yeah.
But he's a beautiful writer, Zweig.
Yeah, Zweig's brilliant.
Yes.
He's a good writer.
And where the cottages in Austria, all these people used to go to in 1910-20.
Yeah.
Kokoschka, Zweig, Schnitzler.
Schnitzler?
The whole group.
Everybody.
Used to go there.
It has to be said, I mean, the list of Austrians, it kind of goes extended, go up and up and up all the time.
Huge amount.
In every sense.
In every kind of aspect, philosophy, mathematics, cinema, journalism.
Krauss.
What was the name of Krauss' satirical magazine? Das Licht or something like that? Very interesting. And it's quite this combination of Austria and Spain.
You have the Habsburgs, of course.
Yeah, that you are. Charles V.
Yeah.
The builder of the empire, the builder of the Spanish empire, was an Austrian. From the Habsburg. I promise that. But thank you so much for this evening. It has been fantastic.
I just wanted to tell you one thing. When Arturo died.
Yeah.
Was on Christmas Eve.
Did he die on Christmas Eve, didn't he?
Really?
1957.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I was asleep. Ilse came to get me and told me and asked me to help her lift Arturo back onto the bed.
Okay.
And
was he on the floor?
No, he was sort of half
okay.
off the bed. And he had a heart attack. And he died in Ilse's arms.
24th of December.
Yeah.
Jesus, he was 60 years old, wasn't he?
Exactly 60 years. I've got a picture on his desk. We had a little Christmas tree. And he sat next to that Christmas tree before he went to bed.
You know that 24 is for us, for the Spanish, for Latin America,
it's the
celebrate Christmas. Not 25th.
It's the same
yeah,
with Austria.
In Austria too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's on Christmas Eve, on the night of Christmas Eve, or at midnight. Yeah. At midnight.
That's right. At midnight.
Oh dear, that was painful.
And what we discovered was he wasn't very well. He'd been 2 weeks in hospital. They sent him home for Christmas. After he died, they discovered he had cancer. The cancer started in his bladder, went all the way up his body, and it was a question of days before it would have affected his brain. That helped Ilse somehow.
He didn't know.
He had no idea, absolutely no idea.
And in many ways it was quick.
Because and in certain ways, merciful.
People die for months with cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, with him, he didn't know it was incurable.
And in certain ways, merciful, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And she knew what was happening because her father died in her arms about 9 years before that. So she knew what was what. And then she went, it was a very nice service in the church with lovely Beethoven music, which Ilse chose, and she went to the graveyard. In Middle Lodge, in Fountain, is the grave of both
parents.
And she went with the...
So Arturo's and Ilse's parents are buried side by side?
Both side by side, but Arturo's ashes were spread over the the graves.
Okay.
But she couldn't open the urn. So she had to come back in a taxi with the urn. And then we went back again.
Yeah, okay.
And like a friend Polish came film. To help open the urn.
Like a Polish film.
Which way?
Which way? I don't know. It sounds like I can tell you what it was.
Ashes to Diamonds.
Brilliant.
Excellent. It just sounds peculiar, you know, there she is trying to undo this.
She had very bad arthritis.
There's a particular
Eugene
Polish
still
film.
Met her in Vienna.
You met her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just before she died. She was very ill.
Yeah, she had.
She was diabetic and all her organs were beginning to fail.
Yeah.
She just wanted to die. And I met Lotte, her sister, and Ilse,
Vienna. Yeah. And the brother came here.
Yeah.
So what a fascinating story, it's amazing. Thank you so much. Fantastic evening. This has been delightful. And thank you so much for tonight. It has been a delightful conversation. Cheerful and, thank you so much.
Why not?
Uli, thank you so much. It has been so nice.
Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.